Welcome to Straight and Curly,
a podcast for self-improvement junkies.
I'm Kelly Exeter.
And I'm Carly Jacobs.
This is episode 114.
Hello and welcome to Straight and Curly. Let's jump straight into the review of the week. So this one comes from Tessa Gold Coast and she says, "Longtime listener and lover of these beautiful and thoughtful souls. Appreciate the range of topics, appreciate their humor and their experimentation on selves and their lives."
Oh, thank you so much, Tessa. I know, well, waving to you on the Gold Coast. I feel like we've had quite a lot of international reviews lately, so nice to have an Aussie review. That's so gorgeous. We so appreciate all the people who have been listening to our ramblings for a long time because you guys are the ones who keep us going. Whenever we start wondering whether the show has run its course or not, inevitably we will get an email or a review from a long-time listener. And, yeah, it makes us realise that we're still doing something right. So, yes. Carly, what's your random thing of the week?
Okay, so my random thing of the week this week is that I've got this pregnancy app called Ovia, and each week it gives you a little benchmark of how big your baby is that week, and they're all complete bullshit because none of them actually match. There's four different categories. There's like fruit and vegetables, weird but cute animals, fun and games, so, you know, like a Barbie doll or something.
Oh, right.
And then the other category is
that's disturbing.
The other category is French patisserie. So it'll be like your baby is the size of a croquembouche or something. So it's all very weird. But I've stuck to the creatures one because that's my favorite. And plus they're getting really cute at the moment. So there was like weasel and then there was a puffin. And this week was slow loris. Do you not know what a slow loris is? Oh my God, this is the whole point of my random weird thing because I screenshotted it and sent it to like the grandparents and everything and none of them knew what it was and they all had to Google it. And then I had this horrifying thought that slow lorises are made up, like drop bears or something. And then I was thinking they're a real thing. I'm pretty sure they're real. So I Googled them and they are actually real. They're definitely a thing, but they are so freaking cute. So if you've never seen a slow loris, Google slow lorises. They're kind of just like really dopey monkeys.
Okay. The visual I have in my head is like a sloth. But you know the sloth, yeah, like out of Ice Age? Is it like that? You know the sloth that talks really slowly? Oh, no, not Ice Age. The one with the rabbit.
Yeah,
sorry.
I think I know which one you mean, yeah. So slow lorises are really similar to what was it that you just said? What are they called?
Oh, sloth, Zootopia. You know the sloth in Zootopia? That's what I've got in my head.
Slow lorises are very similar to sloths, but sloths have hook hands.
Okay.
Slow lorises just have regular hands.
Okay.
And they are so freaking cute. If someone can please remind me, slow loris loves being tickled, I will put that in the Facebook group because it is just the video of the internet. It's this woman tickling a slow loris and then she stops and then he looks at her and he's like, "Keep tickling me." And it's just the cutest thing you've ever seen. But yeah, so Kelly just totally proved my point that no one knows what a slow loris is. And I had to confirm to myself that slow lorises were real and not just a weird internet made up thing.
So no, we're going to do a poll in the group. If like more than 5% of people have heard of a slow loris, I'm going to be staggered. Because like I know my cute fairy animals. Like, come on.
Oh, you're going to die that you didn't know what a slow loris is. They're about to become your favorite. They're so freaking cute.
Cool. So on to recommendation of the week. And my recommendation of the week is just a reminder about the Straight and Curly Book Club. Rosanna and Lauren are having they're holding great conversations and driving fantastic discussions in there. So we're doing Slow, which is my friend Brooke McCallery's book, which makes me really nervous because I'm like, please don't anything say bad about Brooke's book. That's the book.
Say anything bad about the book, though.
You wouldn't think so. It's pretty good book, and it's nothing like controversial in there. But yes, that's the book we're talking about right at this moment. But by the time this episode comes out, it might be a different book. But we've talked about Wizard Bored and Brilliant by Manoush Zomorodi. We've talked about Slow. We've had a good old discussion in there about Mark Manson's subtle art of not giving an F, and which no one actually liked, which was really interesting. Mm. So yeah, get into the, if you love self-improvement books and love reading self-improvement books, just Google Straight and, not Google, face in the Facebook search, type in Straight and Curly Book Club and it will come up, and make sure you answer the questions when you try to answer, try to join the group. Because if you do not answer the questions, we think you're a bot and then we won't let you in. So yes, your recommendation of the week, Carl.
That also applies to the Straight and Curly group. Oh, yes. If you don't answer the questions, I don't let you in.
Yes.
So just answer the questions. my thought process behind this, because I was talking to the girls from the book club group about this, and Kelly, because they were asking, like, if someone doesn't answer the questions, like, what do you do? And Kelly was saying,
I make a judgment call depending on, like, you know, I'll actually, like, go and look and see who they are. And sometimes it'll say they have friends in the group, and then I'll go, okay, you can come in even though you did not answer the question. And the Carly's like, nah, didn't answer the question, no go.
I'm ruthless. My philosophy is that if you can't answer a few simple questions, you're not our people anyway. Like, I just don't think it's that hard. So we had this whole thing. And so they got given the permission, like, oh, sweet, we'll just, like, not let anyone in that doesn't answer the questions. I'm like, yes, do that. So my recommendation of the week is Mission Impossible Fallout. It was such a great movie. Even if you're not into Tom Cruise or Mission Impossible, it's just such a good, fun romp.
It's a bit like the Fast and Furious one, isn't it? Like, I watched Fast and Furious on a plane, like, last year, and, like, I'm not really into those kind of shows, but it was just that. It was just easy, fun.
Yeah, just easy and fun. Also, Tom Cruise does all of his own stunts, literally all of them. Really? Like, there's a scene where he jumps out of a plane and he's got a parachute, and he did all of those stunts himself. It's crazy. Oh, and I mean, I know Tom Cruise is, like, he's a bit divisive, and some people are kind of, you know, oh, he's a bit weird, and, you know, yeah, he's a bit weird, but he's a good actor. So bloody good at his job, and just delivers such a top-notch performance, and yeah, it's excellent. And after seeing that, I've made it very clear that only three people are allowed in the delivery room when I have my baby this year. One of them's Ben, one of them is Chummy from Call the Midwife, and the other one is Liam Neeson. Well, Liam Neeson, just because, I mean, why would you not want him there stroking your hair and saying that everything's going to be fine? So I feel like anyone can calm me the way that Liam can.
I'm just having flashbacks to when I had Jaden and Ant, like.
Was Liam Neeson
just
there?
No, Ant was Liam Neeson, because he was just, his head, he was staring at the clock that was on the wall above my head and just stroking and stroking, like, to the point where I'm surprised he did not stroke a, like, bald patch into my hair because he thought there was going to be a sheet in the in the kind of, like, the pre having your baby thing where you go with your partner and they show you what happens. Like, he said there was a sheet, but there was no sheet for you. Where was the sheet? So he fixated on this clock so he didn't have to look at what was going on down below. And it was so funny because, yeah, it just reminded me of that. Anyway.
That's so nice.
Poor guy. It's so hard for the guys because, they can't do anything unless they are a, like, obstetrician themselves or a midwife themselves. So, you know, they can only really just stroke your hair. And sometimes, like, I didn't get the full-on angry pregnant woman kind of thing, but a lot of people do, where they're just, like, you know, gripping their partner by the throat and going, you're the one that brought me. Some really funny.
See, that's why I need Liam there, because he'll calm Ben as well. It's just, it's a mutually beneficial arrangement.
So just throw it out there, Liam, if you're listening, Carly. Well,
if you're listening,
would like you to be there at her birth.
But if failing being able to get Chummy or Liam Neeson, I want the two sidekicks from Luther and Benji, their names are. That combination, just, yeah, lethal, man. Like, we can just, like, you can just get shit done with them in the room. So just make it public. If I'm in a position where I can't request people, you guys know who's allowed in the room and who's not.
If Ben calls me, I'll be able to tell him who's allowed in, who's not.
Yeah.
So, Carly, if you were our best friend, shoot.
So this one comes from Jerry with a J. I am entering a momentous phase in 7 years of mothering. Our youngest starts kindergarten soon. I live in America and I will go from 12 hours of kid-free time per week to 35. she has like a little conversation going here. So her friend says, what are your plans for all the extra time you will gain with both kids in school? She replies, and then internally her brain starts spewing 1980s continuous feed computer paper. She says, I have so much I want to accomplish. I have started lists of daily tasks, weekly tasks and projects, and I've started feeling anxiety too. Anxious that I will blow it and not make the best use of this time that I've longed for. I want to look back on the time I spent this school year and feel awesome about it. I want to be balanced, smart, productive, flexible. I'm forcing myself to add all the other words besides productive though, because I'm not going to lie, that's what I'm most excited about. All the things I can cross off my list. So my self-improvement gurus, do you have any straight and curly episodes you would recommend I listen to for guidance? I considered posting my questions in the Facebook group and getting a lot of responses would feel more overwhelming than helpful, at least right now. So I figured I'd start with you guys.
Oh, okay. So my very first thought was, Jerry, that you need to take the pressure off to make the most of it as a first step. Like, I totally get it. I so get that urge to make the most of that time. And I know I am at heart a planner, so I would be doing the same thing. But a really lovely concept that I have come across lately that's very appealing is the idea of allowing things to unfold. So that does not mean sitting around and waiting for things to happen. It's more about projecting only a short way down the path and choosing to do something rather than the best thing, because I do find the best thing gets us all tied up in overthinking to the point where either we don't do anything at all, or we're always wondering if the thing that we did was actually the best thing to do or the best way to make use of that time. So, yeah.
The best thing is the thing you choose, yeah, and the thing you do.
That's it. And I just feel like if you just take one step and then another and then another, and don't lock yourself into the shoulds and the plans. And like, I can't believe these words are coming out of my mouth. Like, my husband, if he was hearing them, would be like, Kelly, are you seriously giving this advice? But I'm just saying it's a new concept that has, you know, made itself available to me, and I really like it, and I find it just works a treat. Yes, if you don't lock yourself in too far down the track, like, a path will emerge and you will just naturally find yourself doing something worthwhile. And I do think the key thing to remember is there's no one set of actions that will make this coming school year balanced, smart and productive. So don't try to cross everything off your list. Start with the first thing and then do the next thing and so on. And also that very first month where your youngest is at kindergarten, I give you permission to do absolutely nothing at all. So I just think you want to give yourself a chance to create the new routines and rhythms that having your kids, both your kids at school, will afford you. And I think once you have an understanding of those routines and rhythms, then you'll have a better understanding of the time that's actually available to you. And then you'll have a better understanding of how you can make that, you know, use that time most productively. So yeah, that was my very long answer. Sorry about that.
My answer is practically identical. I think first of all, take some time to chill out. If you've been parenting full time for 7 years, you'd definitely do some long service leave.
Oh, I love that. I love it.
I also think that you'd benefit really well from the concept of 90-day sprints. So this is a big thing sort of in the online entrepreneurial world, where people train entrepreneurs how to launch a course or, you know, focus on a particular part of their business. So you choose one thing and you concentrate on it for 90 days. So you didn't actually specify what stuff you want to do. So like with a blank slate, that will just give you a little bit of structure at least. So if you pick one thing you want to do, apply it to 90 days. And then also don't forget daily goals as well. So things like writing 1,000 words every day or going for a 5K run every day. That way, even when you have days, and this happens to business owners, I have days where I'm way less productive than I wanted to be. But if I have my daily goals of going to the gym and ending the day with an empty inbox, as long as I do those two things, I don't feel too shit about how much I get done in the day.
Nice. So cool. So I hope that was helpful. Jerry, Jerry. Yeah. So the topic of today is publishing books, writing courses, and getting a job in writing. So because we're both writers, we do get asked a lot of questions about the industry, and there's no way we can cover off every aspect of said industry in this show. So we put out a call out for questions to the group and to our Facebook pages, and we're hoping that by answering some of those questions — we couldn't get to all of them, unfortunately — like, we'll be answering questions many people have. And the first question that we are answering is, how much does it cost to publish a book? Memoir, fiction, novel, kids' picture books, and chapter books?
So I don't have any idea on this one. To be honest, writing a book has never been a massive priority for me, because I know from having friends in the industry, bloggers that I know very well that have published books, books aren't profitable unless you're massive.
Unless you're J.K. Rowling.
Exactly. Like, you're not going to make a lot of money on a book. And I don't have the time right now to work on stuff that's not bringing in money. But that's just a personal choice that I've made that will change in the future. I definitely have a book in me at some stage, but I might have to wait till I'm retired before I do that.
Oh, you won't have to wait that long. We'll do one together, but after the baby.
Yes.
Carly is right. If you are looking to generate an income, books definitely are not the best way to do that. So I'm just going to have a little bit of a, not a rant, but a bit of a quick discourse on the economics of books. So the very best way to generate income from a book is if you have a high-priced product offering that book, that you can leverage that book to bring, like, acting as a lead magnet effectively. Okay, so you're a consultant who charges a high hourly rate, or you have a membership community. So for instance, Carly could write a book about crochet that could act as a lead magnet,
which I'm very interested in doing, if anyone would like to publish that for me.
Yeah, and that can act as a lead magnet into her crochet coach community, and that's really how she's going to make an income off the book. The books, you know, even if she gets a publisher, she might get advances are very, very small these days. If you get an advance over $5,000, that's for a brand new writer with, you know, unless you have like some kind of massive following that you can show that you've got. And even then, publishers aren't really interested in people who don't have a following. So that's the other thing. You need to have a following before you can go with a publisher. So that's why people end up self-publishing. But yeah, your advance is very small. Most people don't earn out their advance, so they never see any royalties. So yeah, it's very hard to make an income off the book itself. So a guy, James Stramco, who I worked with last year, he has two membership communities, one that is roughly $1,000 a year to join, and one that is much more expensive, and it's like a $10,000 buy-in to get into that group. So it's very easy for someone like him to commit to the costs of a book, because he knows he only needs to sell like two memberships to that most expensive coaching offering, and he makes back his investment, you know. And then a book is something that it never goes away. You've always got it, and you can use that book to open doors for you that were previously shut. So you can get on podcasts that previously you couldn't get on before, or you can get speaking opportunities. So a book opens a lot of doors, and you can leverage the opening of those doors to make an income, but it's very rare for the book itself to make you a good income.
I'll just interrupt super quickly here, because Lisa Messenger, who has written so many books, she calls her books very expensive business cards.
Yes, and that's really what they are. But if you use those business cards in an effective manner, they can be very, very —
absolutely.
You know, they can pay off for you very well. But it's just, you know, it's like a business decision. It's like any business decision. You're about to make an investment of time, because don't forget about the time investment that's involved in writing a book. Every hour that you spend writing a book is an hour that you're not generating income in another way. And quite often when I ghostwrite books, it's not necessarily because the person can't write, but it's because I'm a fast writer. They're not a fast writer. And they're like, well, it makes sense for me to pay you to do it, because you can do it faster than me. And while you're writing the book, I can go and make money doing the thing that I do, you know. So it's all, yeah, it's all business decisions when you're doing this. So the other thing that needs to be emphasized is it's not enough to write a great book. Marketing a book takes a lot of time and money, and if you're not able to get your book into enough people's hands, even if it's a killer book, you won't be able to generate the word of mouth that you need for that book to kind of go on to be a perennial seller. So that's just another thing that you've got to take into account. Now that I've said that, I will say that if you simply want to write a book just because you've always wanted to write a book and you are not fazed by the investment required, like, go for it, because not everybody wants to or needs to make money from their book. Many people just delight in sharing their ideas with the world or helping people. The picture book that I just did with my son, my primary goal with that was just to have fun going through the process, you know, with him. And we achieved that. We had a lot of fun. We haven't even probably launched it. So I would say, I can't even say how many copies we've sold because we haven't launched it properly because I've been so busy. But, you know, whatever reason you have for writing a book, there's no good reason or bad reason. It's just, I just don't want you to invest money in it with the expectation that you will make that investment back, because there are certain situations in which you won't. As far as specific costs go, if you search Kelly Exeter, how to write a picture book on Google, you'll find a post on my website that details what it costed us to publish the picture book I did with my son. Short story, it cost around $2,500, and it should have cost more, but I can do my own design work, so we had a cost saving there. I think you'd want to budget at least $4,000 for a picture book, because you have to hire an illustrator. For a longer book, either a fiction or a non-fiction chapter book, you want a good structural editor, you want a good line editor, you want a good proofreader and a book designer in order to make your book as professional as possible. And for all of those people, you're probably wanting to budget around $8,000. So, you know, these are all ballpark figures, and you can pay less and you can pay more. But, you know, when it comes to editors and designers, you get what you pay for. So
definitely.
Yes. Carly, are writing courses worth the money or just a money grab?
I think it really depends. What you want to do is make sure that you check out the person who is running the course and make sure that they're legit. So if you see a writing course that you're interested in taking part in, make sure that you click through to that person's Instagram, and if they have, or Twitter or whatever, and if they have like 20 followers and they're trying to teach you how to write for the internet, I'm going to be thinking they're probably not doing it very well if they have zero social following and no proof of the excellence of their own skills. Then I would back away from that type of a person. I can vouch for the Australian Writers' Centre. Mm. They have great teachers and a really good curriculum. There's another writer I love called Alexandra Franzen.
Oh, I love her. She's amazing.
She's brilliant.
I tried to see her for a little while, but then I was like, oh yeah, there's probably only one of her. Anyway.
she's brilliant. She's an American who I think lives in Portland, if I'm not mistaken. She runs live retreats in Hawaii. So she doesn't do any online stuff, but I really think she should, because she's awesome. I also did a really great course that was called Stop Grammar Time in Fitzroy in Melbourne, and that was done by The Good Copy. They run courses sort of all around inner and north Melbourne, and that was amazing. This incredible girl, her name was Penny, I believe, but she was fantastic, just a huge grammar nerd, knew everything, and it was just really good to brush up on my grammar, because I'm a good writer. I know my grammar, but sometimes you sit there going, hang on a minute, is that what's the correct thing here?
No, and I'm same.
It was really good. And it's hard to Google that stuff. So it was really good to have that kind of thing. But in terms of an actual writing course, I was looking at it going, how to make it as a freelance writer. I couldn't actually find one. And I was actually just thinking, hey, Kelly, that might be a little something we could do together.
No, I don't do online courses. But do you know what we should do together? We should do a writing retreat together. We totally need to do one of those, because I do have a good online freelance writing course type thing. Australian Writers' Centre does one. So are writing courses worth the money or just a money grab? Look, it depends what you're looking to get out of them. Like, if you are looking for a straight return on investment, then you would do freelance writing stage one course from the Australian Writers' Centre. So I did that years ago. It taught me literally everything I needed to know about pitching to magazines, about structuring stories for magazines and writing for magazines and newspapers. If you're looking to do a course that will save you money just by, you know, stopping you making stupid mistakes or helping you navigate a process like self-publishing in a more linear way, then any reputable writing course or organization will fit that bill. But as Carly said, with any industry, there's always going to be people out there who are looking for the money grab, and it is a case of buyer beware. So I would always ask around in writers groups on Facebook to see if anyone else has done the course that you're thinking of doing, and, you know, get their input before you drop any money on it. Like with when I did the Australian Writer Centre freelance writing course, I noticed in the you know, the testimonials for the course was the name of somebody that I knew. So I got in contact with them and I said, look, this is my situation. This is what I want to learn. Is this course going to teach it to me? And they said, yes, for your specific situation and what you want to get out of it, yes, it's perfect for you. So I just think it's not good enough to say, oh, is this course any good? Because it probably is good, but it's more, is this course good for my particular situation, is a better question to ask.
And also, don't do any courses from people who haven't done the thing that you want to do. There's a lot of people. So, for instance, I'll just use my friend Kate as an example. She teaches blogging and, you know, how to make money online. And she actually had a professional blog for years and has made a lot of money online.
Yeah.
So I don't have any problems directing people to her because she can put her money where her mouth is. And she ran a six-figure blog for, you know, 6 years. And then there are other people who are like, make money blogging online. And aside from teaching that course, they've never actually made money online.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I wouldn't, if someone says, oh, I've written for Vogue, it's like, I want a link or a cutout of the article that you've written for them. I want to see the work that you've done. I want you to list the companies that have paid you to write before I pay you money to teach me how to write.
Yes. Good, good tips. So, the courses that I recommend, pretty much anything from, you know, so courses that I recommend based on the fact that you take the time to check that they are right for your situation, but these are reputable people who I feel do great work. Anything from the Australian Writers' Centre. Kate Toon has the Clever Copywriting School, and that's just brilliant for anyone who's looking to figure out how to build a career writing copy for businesses, so be it social media posts, newsletter content, web content. Kate gives great guidance around what to charge and how to charge. She has kind of swipe files and templates for writing certain things. She has a great community, so that the community of writers, they're very supportive of each other. And I've actually, anything where there's an associated community. So when I did the Australian Writer Centre freelance writing course, we also had access to everyone who was doing the course in a Facebook group. And like when the course finished and we were all out there pitching to magazines and, you know, and getting published online, we were all sharing the things that we were learning. So, you know, we would say, oh, like, don't pitch to this person because she's about to leave. So if you want to pitch to that publication, just hold it until, you know, for another month until the new editor has started, or, you know, this person does not like things like this, so just don't go there with that. And so when you have access to fellow writers, a lot of the time that's where the value of the course lies. You know, sure, the content's probably really good, but the access to fellow writers is kind of invaluable. So yes, that's Kate Toon's Clever Copywriting School. And then I also, if you're looking to write a non-fiction book, Jeff Goins, G-O-I-N-S, he has a course called How to Write a Bestseller. And that just gives a really high level process overview for kind of the process that I follow. That's the process he recommends. So whenever anyone asks me, what do you do? I go, I just go do this course, and he just kind of steps people through it. So yeah, so they're courses. How does one get writing jobs like the one you have, Carly, for realestate.com?
So I've actually got most of my freelance work through word of mouth. It's really important to make sure that people know that you want work. Yes. And then they'll tell their friends. So I actually really want to give Alex from Low Tox Life a big shout out here. So I did some work for Alex. It'd be close to 2 years ago now. And then she ended up needing someone full time and I couldn't do it. So we ended up not working together anymore, but she literally replaced herself as a client. She's like, oh, I don't, I can't can't work with you anymore, but I have this other person. And then she hooked me up with one of her mates that owned a coffee company, and I worked for them for a while. And then when, you know, I couldn't work for them anymore, I went back to Alex and I was like, oh, hey, remember how great you were last time? She's like, oh, I've got the perfect person for you. And so now I'm working with one of her really close mates, Amelia from Undercover Architect.
And she's awesome.
Yeah, she's amazing. So, and it's been really great. And she's one of the loveliest clients I've ever had. And we just work really well together. And that's the thing. Like, I really think it's important for me to give Alex a huge shout out, because she's been such a champion of my work and also just connecting people. She's a real people connector. She's the type of person that if you meet her at a conference, she says, I'm going to email you this person's information. She actually does it.
Yeah.
And I try to do the same thing for other people and pass people on to other people, because that's what really makes the freelance world go round. So just make friends with people who are in the industry.
And let them know when, because like, as you said, like Alex hooked you up with Amelia because you went back to Alex when you finished working with the coffee people and said, look, I'm free now if you know anybody.
And she does. Like, she just always knows someone.
She does know everyone.
Yeah, and that's the thing. And, like, I literally have not had to look for a client in 2 years because of her. So, yeah, be friends with Alex from Low Top Life. I've also found graphic designers have been super useful. So if you're a writer, make friends with graphic designers, because they're the ones that know when companies are looking for copywriters. And
I will say I've gotten a lot of copywriting work through my own graphic design company. So I will agree with that.
Exactly. And they're the ones that, so if they're replacing a copywriter or looking for more copywriters, they're going to be the first ones to know. And you might not realize this, but graphic designers and copywriters actually work quite closely together. Mm. And graphic designers want to work with their friends and want to work with nice people. So definitely do that. So I've got a graphic designer cousin who's got me quite a few jobs, including realestate.com. Another thing that has worked so well for me in the freelance space is to just be awesome at what you do. I don't want to blow my own horn, but I have to a little bit here because that's why I've been able to stay
employed
with clients employed. And I only do client work 2 days a week, and if one of my clients decides not to work with me anymore, I've got a list of people that I can call on and be like, look, I've got an opening, do you want that? And I can set my own hours and set my own terms. And I've worked really hard to be able to do that, because I always meet my deadlines. I'm never late with work. If a client has a last minute request, I'll always do it. And as a result, I've pretty much just been taken with people when they leave the company that employed me in the first place. So with realestate.com, I actually don't work for realestate.com anymore. I kind of do. Like, I'm still on their books, but it hasn't kind of really worked out in a while. There were two women that I worked with at realestate.com 6 years ago. They both left and took me to their next companies, and then they both left those companies and went to other companies, and I'm still working for both of them now. So it's if you constantly deliver a quality product, people will want to keep working with you. That's all they want. They just want quick work, people who are easy to work with, people who deliver shit on time.
Oh, just people who can be relied on. I just know straight up the amount of people do what you say you'll do, and you will never lack work, because you will be staggered at how rare that is. So if you're someone that can be relied on, and if you're someone who can – you don't want to build a brand on being the person who can turn things around quickly on a dime, but – if you're someone that people know they can rely on you, and you're able to set reasonable boundaries for yourself, you'll never be out of work. But you do have to, you know, you have to put yourself out there to start, don't you, Carls?
Definitely. So my last point, particularly if you're going to, if you don't have those connections, I've made those connections over time. If you're brand new and putting yourself out there, definitely do that and approach brands. But if I was starting fresh tomorrow in copywriting and I didn't have any connections and I was looking for places who might hire me, I would go for insurance companies, I'd go for car companies, I'd go for banks and anything medical. They have money.
Yeah. And, you know, like you said, if you're starting out completely fresh and cold, approach the companies that have money, but approach them. And it might be something as simple as rewriting their homepage for them. And just, you know, it's hit and miss, but give them a taste of what you can do, or put together a 300-word blog post that could work for their blog, and obviously highlight what a blog, you know, a regular blog could do for them, for from a search point of view and from an engagement point of view. You will have to kind of do some stuff for free and to, you know, to get a little foothold in industry. But I guarantee you that once you get your first paying client and you do an amazing job for them, they will talk about you to other people, and your, you know, your dance card will fill up quick smart. But you do need to find that you want to be in the right industry. You don't want to find a kind of an industry that's very money sensitive and never has any money and wants everything done for free. If you start doing stuff for free for that in just that kind of industry, you'll keep doing stuff for free. So be smart, like Carly said.
And also be very gracious when people decide that they don't want to work with you anymore. I've worked for so many people that have not had ongoing work for me, or have had cash flow issues and have had to, you know, cease working with me. And, you know, it's never fun, and it's always a bit disappointing. You're like, oh, great, now I have to find another client. But by not behaving like a complete tool about it every time someone decides they can't work with me anymore, they remember me in 6 months' time as being like, oh, thanks so much, it's been great working with you, and they've had a very pleasant experience ceasing work with me. They remember me in 6 months' time when they do have more work for me. So, yeah, don't act like a dick when people decide not to work with you anymore.
Cool. The next question is, I'd love to hear your take on the Grammarly app for phones and computers. I love Grammarly. I use it. I pay for the premium version of it.
Same.
I use it when I'm editing, and I use it all the time, and I find it's great for when I'm tired and I don't want to read through something, or I've been working on something and it's been through like five or six drafts and I've lost all perspective on it. Grammarly will at least just point out the obvious errors to me and make it easy for me to edit. It also highlights passive voice for me, and I do tend to slip into passive voice a lot. So it highlights those things, and I find passive voice very hard to spot on my own.
Same.
I am, however, not a slave to Grammarly. It's just one of the tools that I use, but I do find it's good for making sure that if I'm going to break a grammar rule, and I'm doing it with intent and not just because I'm tired and I'm on to my 10th draft of this piece of writing. So, yeah.
Yeah, I'm exactly the same. I have Grammarly. I pay for Grammarly. I'm, again, not a slave to it, but I use it for – I will run everything that I send to clients through it before I send it through to clients, just to make sure that all the grammar is under control. Sometimes it wants to replace words really inappropriately, though. Like, it always – I use the word obviously a lot, and it always wants to replace obviously with apparently.
Oh, right. Or it just wants you to take it out because it's an adverb and you just hate the adverbs, and I'm like, I love adverbs, and I'm damn well leaving them in there.
Exactly. And I'm like, shut up, you don't know me, Grammarly.
And the next question is, where or how can you test your ideas before launching into a year-long project? There's any number of ways of doing this. So a project I'm doing at the moment with my friend Darren Rouse, like, we want to do a book together. We have an idea for it. We're not really sure what the hook is. So we've just finished running a 30-day challenge around that topic. And it's been really interesting seeing what people responded to. Like, we wrote a blog post around that topic. So it was interesting to see what resonated with people within that blog post. But then we ran a challenge related to the topic of that blog post. And then it's been interesting to see the themes that have been recurring through, you know, the course of that challenge. And we're actually going to sit down this week and kind of go through those themes and try and figure out, yeah, what the next step is. But yeah, I do fully endorse this idea of test your idea before you go and drop a whole year of effort and time onto it.
Definitely.
With book title ideas, I test them constantly on people. Like, when I came up with a title for James Shamko's book, Work Less, Make More, I tested that. I said it to every entrepreneur I knew, and I watched their facial expression when I said it. And it was always, you know, they just got a little light in their eye, like, tell me more. With my book that is still, I just can't get to write, Overthinkers Anonymous, when I say that title to the right person, like, they just get this look on their face and they just get a wry little smile, and they just give me a little nod, and they're like, which says to me, yeah, I, I need that book when it's written, let me know. And it's funny because the people who don't get it, who it's interesting, people either get it or they don't. So that tells me it's a good title for the people who do get it. So you just test, in, you know, Facebook groups are amazing for that. In the Overthinkers Anonymous group, like if there's a concept that I want to see, if this concept has, you know, under the Overthinkers Anonymous kind of banner, if I want to see if this concept has resonance or if I'm testing a theory, I test it in the group to see what people think. And yeah, I've learned a lot from doing that. So yes, thoroughly endorse the idea of testing your ideas before going into them. Carl's?
I always tend to look outside of my test group of people in order to find out if an idea is actually viable. So most of the stuff that I've ever done has been aimed at, I've actually got a friend who is kind of my avatar. Like she's, you know, a professional who works in a job that she enjoys. She likes interesting things. You know, she has a decent disposable income. And so I will always make sure that whatever I'm doing is aimed at people like her. But then I always make sure that I ask people who aren't like her so that they can look at the viability of the idea. I'll often go to Ben's employees because they're mainly male and they're programmers. So they're not very creative. Sorry, that was not like a, that wasn't a slight on them or anything, but they're very analytical, mathematical people. And I can throw an idea at them and they won't look at it in a, yes, an that's very creative. Manner,
they'll look at it in a more analytical kind of way.
In a very practical manner. So I will often throw ideas past them and generally one of them will be like, oh, let me do some research on that. And then I'll end up with like a little report as to whether or not that's going to be a viable idea. So I think it's really important to throw your ideas around to the people that you're aiming them at, but also throw them around to people you're not aiming them at.
And I also say, don't ask people if they will pay you money for something. Ask people to pay you money for something.
Yeah.
That is, yeah. Asking people whether they'll pay you money for something is will not yield you good, honest results. Until people actually put money down on your idea, it's not a good idea. Or at least if you're trying to make money off that idea and they and people won't put money down on it, it's not a good idea. And final question under this banner of publishing books and writing courses and jobs in writing is how to handle feedback / criticism without taking it personally.
My thing is that if it's for a client, I'll take the criticism on board and make adjustments. And I also like to look at it that I didn't do the wrong thing. It was just that this specific idea of what it was supposed to look like to the client looked a bit different in what I presented to them. If it's from a reader or a listener of the podcast, honestly, a lot of negative feedback in my experience comes from misunderstandings or projections, which are usually solved with a gentle and warm conversation. So if someone was offended by something that I said, generally one of two things happened. I worded it incorrectly, in which case I can apologize for that mm-hmm. and not do it again, or the person read it wrong.
Yeah.
And I can look at my words and say, look, that if you look at what I said or look at what I read, that's not actually what I said. Do you need to talk about this? And the person will be like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I think you just triggered something in me, blah, 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 blah. So that's how that sort of always works out for me. And I mean, I used to stew on things for days as well, but I've gotten to the point where I'm just too old and busy for that bullshit. Like really, I'm not going to let a negative, like some negative feedback ruin an entire week of my life. And it takes work to get rid of those yucky feelings, but it's just so much worse feeling like a complete chump for wasting a week worrying about someone who probably didn't give you a second thought after they gave that negative review. So yeah, like I'm really, at the moment, I'm really concentrating on not letting what other people think of me bother me at all because it's just such a waste of time.
Yeah. I mean,
do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I'm with clients. I really desperately need clients to love what I'm doing. And I get really bummed out and a bit stressed and anxious if they don't. But that's because the work that I'm doing with clients is it's their book and it's their baby and it has to be right and they have to trust
that's
me.
That's a different kettle of fish.
Yeah, totally different kettle of fish. If I personally am sending my own writing to an editor and I'm getting feedback on my writing from an editor, I take everything on board without taking anything personally because, one, I know that being edited is a huge gift and it's the one thing that has made my writing better more than anything else. And two, as an editor, I know when I'm editing something, like, my feedback is absolutely never personal. Like, all I want to do is make that piece of writing as strong as it possibly can be so it can connect as well as it possibly can with the intended audience. I'm not thinking about the writer at all, and I can be quite blunt. Anyone who's ever been edited by me, sorry. But yeah, I only care about the writing and the reader and it can, and the writing connecting with the reader. And I don't care about the author's feelings too much, because I just want that piece of writing to be the best that it can be. And so when I'm being edited, I kind of take that, I assume that my editor is the same. They don't really care about my feelings. They only care about the writing being as strong as it can be. Maybe that should take a softer approach, but at the end of the day, it takes too long to dance around writers' feelings.
It really does.
It gets in the way of making the writing as good as it can be. Other feedback, like criticism, like say from readers, I won't read 1-star reviews. Like, I know people who read them and then feel bad about themselves, and I just think life's too short to read 1-star reviews, especially when you have like 100 5-star or 4-star reviews and then there's 1 1-star review. Why would you read the 1-star review? People are compelled to. I'm not, for whatever reason, self-preservation maybe. But I kind of subscribe to Liz Gilbert's way of thinking, which is the thing is written and published. I can't actually do anything about it. If you hated it, it does not serve me to know that you hate that. It doesn't. I can't go back and make that piece of writing better for you now. So it's no point knowing. So yeah, I just put my best effort into creating, and then I'm on to the next thing. So yes. So that's the topic for the day done. On to what we kicked ass at this week, Carls. What did you kick ass at?
So I'm working with some really awesome brands at the moment through Smaggle, but I'm self-managing for the first time and it's going really, really well. I'm really loving representing myself and it's just so much easier than going through agents. And I obviously love my agents. They're great because they have excellent connections and, you know, they're actually in the industry. But even great agents are kind of, can be a bit of a wall between you and the brand. I'm just finding that I get things done so much more quickly when feedback comes back from the client. It doesn't feel as harsh because it's not coming. A lot of the time with agents, I've had a problem of them dulling down what the brand has said to preserve my feelings. And then I've changed the sponsored post that I was doing and sent it back, but it's still not right because there was a preservation of feelings happening in there. Whereas brands will come and say, we can't have this because legal doesn't like it. And I'm like, cool, then I can change it to something else. It's just really great having that autonomy and also just like proud of myself for being like a proper, you know, like it's not something I've ever really done before, but I understand what my product is and I understand what Smaggle is and what it stands for and what the readers are into. So I really am the best person to represent it. And yeah, I'm kicking ass at that at the moment, which I'm really enjoying.
Oh, very nice. My kicking ass thing is a book that I'm working on at the moment. The client is just really stoked at how it's all come together. I'm really stoked at how it's all come together. I'm quite a hard marker and I'm always thinking about the reader and is this book delivering value to the reader and is it delivering on the promise that's being made in the title? And this particular book like is just ticking all the boxes. So the client's happy and I'm happy. It's out next month and I can't wait for it to be out. So yes.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. So simultaneously, kicked our ass. I have a few projects, this one included, where like kind of they've collided simultaneously and they are like, I'm kind of working on 4 major book projects and editing 2 others. So I'm having to kind of split and compartmentalize my brain in some really weird ways at the moment. And I am a bit vague because I'm thinking about book titles and I'm also thinking about like kind of transition problems in the book. And like, so I'm a bit vague at the moment around my family and I don't like being like that around them. So it's kicking my ass at the moment, but it should hopefully just free up a little bit soon.
Yeah, I don't really have one. I think this is going to be my week where I don't have a kicked out ass. One thing, like if I'm really stretching it, my burping is back, which is gross. So I don't know if you guys listen or if I've mentioned this before, but I've had no pregnancy symptoms whatsoever. I've had really good energy, no morning sickness. Please don't hate me. I already feel like the biggest asshole in the world for having such an easy pregnancy. But I burped basically for the entire month of April, and then it came back again in June, and then I thought I was done with it, but it's back again. So it just seems like I just turn into a giant belchy troll when I'm pregnant.
Oh, it's the worst feeling. I hate that burpy feeling.
But I haven't changed. But the thing that's so frustrating is that I haven't changed anything.
It might just be where the baby's sitting. It just has to sit in a very certain place.
Ugh. It's not really kicking my ass. It's just funny more than anything. It's just, I'm like, oh, great. And my friend was like, I was at her house and I'm just like trying to burp really quietly behind my hand, and she's like, is the burping back? I'm like, yeah, it's back. She's like, just go for it, babe. So I'm just like just belching, and she's like, it's extraordinary. Like, it's guttural. It's like burping that no one has ever experienced before. It's hilarious. Yeah, so I guess that's my kicked our ass this week. But
what a way to wrap up the show. On that note.
Time to wrap up. Don't forget that we do have a Patreon page. If you love the show and want it to continue, if you could kick a couple of dollars in our direction per month, we are trying to get to $500 per month of pledges, and we're getting there slowly, but a nice big influx of Patreons would just be excellent. If you love listening to the show and you want to support it, just visit patreon.com/straightandcurly.
Yes. And finally, do jump into the Facebook group and share your thoughts about this week's show and any other questions you might have. We will do our very best to answer them and continue the discussion. See you in there. Thank you so much for listening to Straight and Curly. This week's show notes and links will be available at straightandcurly.com.
And if you have any questions or weird self-improvement hacks you want us to trial, you can tweet us at Kelly Exeter or at Smaggle, or you can email us at hello@straightandcurly.com.